Okay. So the motivation for this work, I suppose, is easiest to state in terms of the catchphrase that most quantum states are unphysical in some sense. So what I mean by that is that a typical state in Hilbert space, if you pick it Haar randomly, is massively entangled and locally featureless in the sense of local observables have zero expectation values. However, the physical states we observe in nature often obey area laws and are well described by local variables. And so we would like to develop a way of describing those physical states we observe. And in recent years, the areas of matrix product states and PEP states have been designed and developed with this in mind. They obey area laws and describe the states we observe or the systems we observe quite well. And so there's the catchphrase that we want to describe the physical corner of Hilbert space. Well, what about quantum field systems? So we know that finite dimensional systems, the Hilbert space is very big, and this just gets worse for infinite dimensional systems or a field system. And so really, we want to look at the intersection of quantum information theory and quantum field theory and try to extend these notions into the area of quantum field systems. And so bring ideas in quantum information theory that are recently developed and extend them to continuum field scenarios. And so really, the work is situated between these two areas. And so it presents a problem that I have to target two audiences at the same time, and half the time I'm saying things that are trivial to one group and the other time trivial to the other. Or you might have the situation that people might wonder, why should I be interested in this? Well, if I were speaking to someone in quantum field theory, I could say that we really want to bring new insights from entanglement theory and apply them in the area of quantum fields. And observe that in discrete scenarios, especially in one-dimensional discrete scenarios, matrix product states have been incredibly successful, providing new variational methods, classification of phases, and exactly solvable models. And so really, it's almost like developing a new toolkit that's applicable across quantum field states, and a toolkit which isn't dependent on the physical content of your field system. So talking to a quantum information person, I'd simply point out that quantum field theory is a large fraction of physics. And it would be nice to extend ideas into relativistic scenarios, but also to the ideas of quantum simulators. You know, people actually interested in building simulators in, say, condensed matter systems or quantum optics that simulate exotic field states and, say, high-energy regime physics or strongly interacting field systems. And also just to extend the scope of the tools that people have masters in the discrete scenario to the continuum. Okay, so really this talk is divided into sections, and because it gets a little complex at points, I've really provided an overview or a roadmap of what I'll talk about. So I'll briefly review what I mean by discrete matrix product states, then move on to the continuum, and then explain why looking at path integral form might be useful, and then describe how these ideas extended into two or higher dimensions. And the thing to keep in mind is that, well, the equations, sorry, the equations may be reformulated at each step, either in terms of an initial formulation or path integral representation. But the systems don't necessarily change. So say, for example, going from here to here. And so in the first step, it'll be discrete to the continuum, and then a reformulation of the continuum, and then the final step. So I'll explain what these mean. So okay, the first step. So discrete quantum states, multipartite systems. And if you have a discrete multipartite system and a pure quantum state, then it always has a representation in terms of what are called matrix product state representation. And so a pure quantum state chi can be represented in this way here, in which it's an expansion in terms of the computational basis or an orthogonal basis for the system, with an amplitude given in a particular form of a product of matrices of a certain dimension. So you really have a set of matrices with a physical index, I, telling you the amount of the computational basis state. But it also has a virtual index, which is the index of the matrix itself, so alpha, beta. And really, this, the fact that D is fixed is really regulating the degree of entanglement in the system. So for D equals 1, you can only have product states. For D equals 2, you can have a state on n systems, but a bounded level of entanglement. And so you should view D as a regulator of entanglement, and which foliates the Hilbert space. And as you increase D, you increase the amount of entanglement, and if you increase it large enough, you can reach any state in the Hilbert space. Sorry, what was that? Oh, sorry, thank you. So it's a product of matrices, but the amplitudes have to be numbers. And so you really take an inner product of what can be viewed as states of a virtual system. So this here are the physical degrees of freedom, but you're imagining a virtual degree of freedom, a virtual quantum degree of freedom. And you can view this as starting in a state omega r and ending in a state omega l. Okay, so this will become more clear as I go along. So really what you have is a variational class of states with the coordinates or parameters for the manifold of states given by these matrices. So it can be quite complex, but it defines a natural hierarchy in terms of the degree of entanglement. And it has been found to provide efficient classical simulation and analytical tools. And even by restricting to D equals 2 or 3, you get many significant states in quantum information theory, such as cluster state or AKLT. Now, maybe to go back to your question, as I suggested, it admits a description which is physically sensible and intuitive. And the picture is that this physical pure state arose from a sequential interaction of the physical degrees of freedom with a single discrete auxiliary system. So this is the pitch you should keep in mind, that there's a virtual or auxiliary system which is discrete and of dimension capital D, which sequentially interacted with the physical state, creating entanglement, and generating the state chi. And more importantly, all of the physics of the physical pure state gets encoded in the dynamics of this virtual system. And the dynamics is dissipative dynamics. And so this is an important thing to keep in mind, and it'll be iterated again and again. The physical state is fixed. There is no time or no dynamics. Any dynamics is implicit or virtual. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay, so I've described the discrete scenario. Now, it was recently done that this description was moved into the continuum. And so really, instead of a set of discrete physical systems, you're going to have a continuum being the physical system. But you still have a discrete virtual system, a discrete auxiliary system. Well, you might say, okay, why go to the continuum? You know, what's wrong with staying on the lattice? Well, there's a nice quote, which I think is in some, at least an initial justification. It says that number theory is hard because calculus is so powerful. And the, if you think about it, what it means is the discrete systems are hard because you don't have access to powerful tools of the continuum like calculus. And so this alone is a justification, especially for two-dimensional discrete scenarios where often calculations are intractable, sharp P hard, and hard to describe. Okay, so we want to take a continuum of some kind. So the physical system has initially n discrete systems, and we really want to take this n to infinity. For simplicity, we also allow the degrees of freedom of the physical system to be unbounded, and imagine n discrete oscillators that are physical with a single virtual or auxiliary system of dimension capital D. And we perform this sequence where you keep the total length fixed but increase the number of points. Now, if you've ever looked at Poisson processes or the idea of distributing sand grains along an interval, you know roughly how this proceeds. You really want to keep a bounded expectation value, but allow the number of points, physical points you access to be unbounded. And if you do this, the MPS matrices you use in that limit actually become quite simple. Instead of a whole complex set of D by D matrices, you're actually forced to use a particular type. And it really comes down to two matrices, a Q or an R. Now, the intuition is that, as I said before, this index, the upper index is a physical index. And you should view this as an excitation of the physical system. So zero is going to correspond to a zero expectation, whereas a one can be viewed as a single excitation or a single particle. And so as you're taking this limit where you're shrinking the physical points closer and closer, for consistency, creating one particle here and one particle here, as you shrink those points together, you want that to be consistent with creating two particles at the same location. And so that intuition really forces the form that these matrices take. And so a K particle excitation is given by this here, whereas this is almost like a vacuum term, which must have the identity, because you want some stability. So if you take these matrices and put them into the original form I gave for the MPS and take a limit, the form simplifies a great deal. So this is the original form, and if you use the previous A, taking the limit, it becomes this here, where this is really viewed as a continuum time dynamics of the discrete auxiliary system as it couples to a physical system. So this looks initially intimidating, but it's not so bad. We have a time-ordered exponential in which this term here is coupling the auxiliary system to the physical system, while the auxiliary system has a Hamiltonian K, which is related to the Q in the previous slide, but the details aren't important. You can simply view K as the an effective Hamiltonian for the auxiliary system. Yes? Yes. So this will end up giving rise to coherence. Yes. Yes?
When you say that you are restricted to the states of the type you were writing the previous slide, you're restricting the Hilbert space somehow, right? I mean, what is the class of states that can be written in this way?
So the situation is that if you take n oscillators and then let and you have a Hilbert space for that set of n oscillators. If you take n going to infinity, you end up with a nasty Hilbert space, which is non-separable. And you really want to restrict to a separable Hilbert space, which has a finite expectation value for particle number. So you want expectation value of n to be some finite value. It can be unbounded in terms of the number of particles that can be excited, but the Fock space is constrained by this finite expectation value. And so this is analogous to a Poisson process where you might have infinite number of points along a line, but there are a finite number of grains of dust on the line. Or in the night sky, you have a finite number of stars distributed, but an infinitely many points in the sky. And so you are restricting, but you're saying, I'm not going to have I want a separable Hilbert space. Yeah. Okay. Oh, and it should be emphasized that you can reach all states in the Fock space with this representation. With a suitably large D. Yeah. As I said, it's a foliation. Well, this dynamical or virtual description is a continuous interaction with a discrete d-dimensional auxiliary system where you can view it as having swept out and created the physical field state through a continuous interaction. Well, there's actually a concrete scenario which basically describes this. Instead of having the virtual system be virtual, you can actually consider it to be a genuine process where the discrete system is fixed and the field moves in a sense. And so in cavity QED scenarios, this is exactly what you have. You have a D-level atom or a D-dimensional system inside the cavity and an output field leaking out. And it turns out that this is exactly the same situation. So K can be viewed as an atom Hamiltonian, whereas R is the atom cavity coupling. And so you could, for example, use the correspondence to engineer quantum field states through the manipulation of these degrees of freedom. And so use it as a quantum simulator. Okay, so then the question is, can we extend this to higher dimensions? And in particular, we'd like to have physical field states that have symmetries of certain kinds. So this was a problem for a while. The problem wasn't how to define higher dimensional formulations, because you could just posit a similar form, some sort of boundary system sweeping out a higher dimensional state. But there wasn't a derivation from a first principles or discrete scenario, and there wasn't a clear picture of how to encode symmetries in the state. So what do we use to guide ourselves? Well, we want to view it as being generated by a virtual process where a lower dimensional field state sweeps out over the physical degrees of freedom. And we would like symmetries to be present in some way. The reason I want it to be a lower dimensional field state is, if I have a two-dimensional physical field state, I want to view it almost like Russian dolls, where you encode a two-dimensional physical field state in the dynamics of a one-dimensional field state moving. And that one-dimensional field state moving is then described by a zero-dimensional discrete state, as in the previous slides. And the symmetries aspect, when it comes to field theories, at least suggests that you might want to consider path integral formulations. So where I've described the continuum 1D, I'll now say how this one-dimensional expression, which is quite intuitive, can be reformulated as a slightly more intimidating path integral formulation, but still has intuition. Okay, and I'll assume that some people haven't seen path integrals in a little while, so I can give a brief recap. Yeah. Is that okay? So really, the basic idea is actually quite simple. You really have some initial state which undergoes some unitary dynamics and finishes in some final state. And you write it as a sum over paths with e to the I s of the path, where s is, it turns out to be an action. And the basic trick is the following. You break the dynamics up into infinitesimal chunks, little time evolutions. And in between each little evolution, you put a resolution of the identity operator. So for example, sum over position states. You put each in here. And you get overlaps such as this here. But because this is to order epsilon, you can expand to linear order in epsilon. And then you have the Hamiltonian sandwiched between two position eigenstates, which can be evaluated. You evaluate that, and you put it back in. If you do that, this is exactly what you get, where the sum over the intermediate points is just really from the resolutions of the identity. And taking the n going to infinity limit, this is basically defined as this path integral. And by identifying the exponent, you find in the traditional case an action which is of the usual form. And so really we're going to do the same procedure, but starting from the abstract continuous matrix product state formulation. So basic recipe is break up the dynamics into small chunks, insert resolutions of the identity, evaluate the matrix elements, take the continuum. Okay? Well, we want to do that here. And there's a relatively obvious place to do it because we're viewing this as some virtual dynamics. So we take this, break it up into infinitesimal steps, and insert a resolution of the identity. Well, in one dimension anyway, the auxiliary system is discrete. However, because we really are interested in higher dimensions, we still want to do a path integral formulation. And so the resolution is to view this discrete system as actually being in one particle sector, so a bunch of D modes. Ah, no, the auxiliary system is the atom. Yes. Yeah. So each of the D orthogonal states for the virtual system, you just map to like one particle in each mode state. The reason for this is to make it more natural when we go to auxiliary system being a field. And so the K matrix, you just map it over to something like this here. So it acts entirely in one particle space. So we've done something kind of trivial. It just made it look more complex. And same for this here. So we have the amplitude. And as you, I think, anticipated, the natural thing to use is coherent states. So you have that the coherent states are complete, and so you're really putting in this resolution in here. And that you then have amplitudes to work out to first order in epsilon given by this here. However, you can use a special property of coherent states, such as these two here. The overlap of two coherent states is given by this expression here. But the exponential, the exponent, because this is between S and S plus epsilon, can be expanded, and you obtain a derivative term in the exponent. And so this is really generating the action term that we want. So expand to order epsilon, and we'll just use shorthand, these kind of D modes. It's just sticking in a vector, D components. And the result is quite simple in some ways, that the one-dimensional CMPS state can be expressed in the following form, where this physical state is a coherent physical state. And the amplitude associated to it is given by this term here, basically e to the is, where s is an action for a discrete d-dimensional quantum system given by this here. So the picture really is that the physical state is a superposition of minimal uncertainty classical field states. And so you can view it as the virtual a discrete system undergoes some sort of dynamics which leave an imprint on the physical system. And that physical imprint comes about through the R coupling. Okay, I'll just say briefly that one particularly nice aspect of this setting is that if you want to compute expectation values of physical observables, because of the description, you can map this onto computations of involving discrete D by D matrices. So the number operator in the field scenario, it's a continuum system, but it can be re-expressed entirely in terms of D by D matrices, so 2 by 2 or 3 by 3. So it genuinely is providing discrete handles on field systems in some way, at least in one dimension. Okay, how long do I have? 15? Okay, good. Okay, so I provided this reformulation of the CMPS as a path integral. However, you can actually look back at the discrete case and reinterpret it. You can actually view a pure quantum state on a multipartite system as having a discrete path integral description where the same thing happens, where you have an action in which a virtual system is coupling to the physical one, and the action is given by this here. Yes? Yes. Yes.
They look like Gaussian, but the two-level system, you cannot write it as Gaussian unless you put non-linear. So is there dividend non-linear?
No, there's no non-linearity. It's in the discrete case.
For example, if I look at the action,
yes.
It doesn't look like an action of two-level.
Yes. Yeah, the interpretation in the discrete case is sometimes problematic. It's not entirely clear. Yeah, but I, at the very least, viewing it as an action gives some intuition. Because really, you can view this as a Legendre transformation, and this is the Hamiltonian. Yeah, basically. Yeah, so this is the Hamiltonian. Yeah. But this carries across to the hard. Okay, so I'm really going to do a similar type of thing, but now for two dimensions. And so the reason this is this shape here, and it's similar to this here, is because this is now a one-dimensional virtual field, which is sweeping out the physical degrees of freedom and creating a state. And so the same story will apply as applied in one dimension. And we expect a coherent physical field state, and you get a superposition of these minimal uncertainty two-dimensional field states, and their amplitudes are given by an action describing the boundary field. So, well, we want a natural extension. And we'd actually like, for example, rotational symmetry. And it to be generated by dissipative dynamics of a one-dimensional auxiliary field system. OK, so I think I've said those. Yes, please. The class of states is complete if you take the size of the bomb dimension big enough. Yes. So in the one-dimensional case, it would be like saying that the atom that sweeps out the physical system is extremely big. It has many degrees of freedom. And it generates whatever physical state you want by some complicated dynamics. Yes.
Yes. So saying you can always write it like this.
Yes. So in some sense, this can be viewed as a generalization of mean field theory. In the sense that you're, if you take d equals one, then it's basically mean field theory. But you're allowing for more structure by using matrices that couple the degrees of freedom. But the matrices stay finite, and so it you have a slightly well-behaved. Okay, so in two dimensions, there's a natural discrete set of states in quantum information theory called PEP states, or projected entangled pair states. The name isn't so important. I'll just focus on what the ingredients are. It's a generalization of MPS, and instead of matrices being multiplied together, it's really just tensors being contracted together. And so you might have some sort of graph structure, and at each vertex you have a tensor associated to it. And the amplitudes for the physical states are obtained by contracting the tensors according to the graph structure. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that at this point on the physical graph, you have a tensor with one physical index and six auxiliary or virtual indices. And depending on how the legs connect to other sites, you contract, you know, alpha 2 with beta 3. And this gives you out a number for each I1, I2, and that's the amplitude. So it's actually quite simple, and it's a natural generalization. So for the two-dimensional case, we want rotational symmetry, and the lattice structure that I consider is actually this here. And I'll explain why in a moment. But it's really this, iterated and connected in two dimensions. And so we've a lattice, and from a virtual perspective, we're going to view it one direction as being the time direction, and the other as a spatial direction. And so a spatial slice, which will be correspond to the virtual boundary system, which will sweep out. And we can reinterpret the index contractions as evolutions along the spatial slice. So each step, it progresses one step. And really, we're going to take this and break it up in exactly the same way we did before. So it's really more of the same. We want rotational symmetry in two dimensions. And I said that the dynamics encode the physical degrees of freedom of the physical state. However, you don't have rotationally symmetric dynamics, okay? But you can do something relatively simple. Rotational symmetry would correspond to x squared plus y squared being invariant, in some sense, under a rotation. However, we can imagine y as corresponding to imaginary time evolution. So it's still a physical process. It's still a CP map, but we're really viewing it as imaginary time. And from the imaginary time perspective, rotational symmetry maps over to a Lorentz symmetry. And so if you find dynamics which are Lorentz symmetric, you can go to imaginary time description, and that corresponds to rotational symmetry on the physical system. So we would like to arrive at some sort of Lorentz symmetric dynamics at the virtual level. Well, we can learn from such systems as, say, graphene, which has Dirac-like low energy excitations, and try and build that into the tensor network description. So the graph structure is chosen because it basically looks like a little kind of mini light cone scenario in which a particle can hop left, hop right, or stay where it is. So it should be pointed out that the one-dimensional scenario had an action which is first-order derivative in time. And we would like rotational symmetry via this, viewing it as Lorentz symmetry process. Now, first-order derivatives appear naturally in Dirac-type actions. And so we're actually aiming at a spinner or Dirac-type description. And if you do this on a lattice, you encounter a theorem, well-known theorem, which basically says that if you want translational and chiral symmetry in the continuum limit, you end up with some sort of doubling going on. But actually here, the doubling occurs at the virtual level. And so all that happens is your bond size just gets doubled up. So it's actually not that bad. So if you do that, I don't give the actual tensors, but all they are if you write down a general quadratic expression and impose symmetry left and right, then it's basically sufficient. So by looking at the virtual description, you can expand in terms of momentum space. You do a discrete Fourier transform and look at the momentum structure, and then assume small energy regime, which makes sense because you're really taking lattice sizes going to zero. And so you're interested in the continuum limit. If you do that, you end up with a set of two-dimensional field states, which are indexed by d by d matrix functions, m, j, and r, where r is the coupling of the virtual system to the physical system. J is viewed as a hopping of auxiliary excitations. And m is like a mass term for these auxiliary excitations. And the action takes this funny form here, where these are Pauli matrices. And once again, the state here is a physical coherent field state, which is a displacement of the vacuum. Well, this is quite a general class of field states, but we now would like to specialize it to a symmetric one. And as I said before, we would like to do that by first making Lorentz symmetric and then going to imaginary time. But if you stare at the previous expression long enough and restrict the matrices in the right way, you can obtain which is what is basically a Dirac-like action, where these gamma matrices are basically for 1 plus 1 dimensions, and they're Pauli matrices. And then you just have to worry about going to an imaginary time description in which the Lorentz metric action goes over to a rotationless metric. And OK, I won't worry about that. And so then the final result is that you end up with rotationally symmetric field states with amplitudes with the correct symmetry. And because this came as a continuum limit of a PEP state, it automatically inherits area law behavior. So this physical state will obey an area law and be described by these coordinates, which are 2D times 2D matrices. And so this is your variational class of two-dimensional field states with the desired symmetry. OK, so I get to sum up. So talking to someone in quantum information theory, I've described how matrix product states are extended to a continuum both in one dimensions and two dimensions. The same construction occurs in three. And also, there wasn't a continuum limit of PEP states before. Also, we can view discrete MPS in almost a path integral representation, which also seems to connect with path integral formulations in circuit, quantum circuits, and the representation of unitary matrices. To a field theorist, I would say that it's a new class of physical field states with entanglement regulated in a natural way. And it's very much working in the position space situation as opposed to momentum space. These states automatically have area laws. And because of the variational class, you have the potential to evade sign problems in Monte Carlo simulation, which is problematic with kind of fermionic background densities. Furthermore, the connection with the discrete work in MPS and PEPS allows the possibility for the construction of exactly solvable field models and the application of new techniques. Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
So are these states Hopper states and the Fock states, or are they normalizable?
Yes. Yeah, they're by construction normalizable, and states within the Fock space. So you don't necessarily worry about the normalization, but this can always be sorted out by a simple redefinition of the variation parameters.
But sometimes, I mean, interesting vacuuma might be actually not normalized or not part of the Fock space.
The ones that leave, yeah, the Fock space.
Yeah.
So nothing.
Maybe you should have non-normalizing states.
Yes. Well, they're normally non-normalizable.
So they're non-normalized.
They're not normalized.
They're not normalized, yeah.
But they can be normalized.
Okay, so they are Hopper states and the Fock space.
Yes, they are. So one might be interested in...
And states which are outside Fock space. Usually, you would say condensates.
Yes, yes.
Would be outside.
Yes. So this is certainly something to look at.
Do we have any idea for which kind of dynamics you might describe, or do they appear as ground states? Or?
So, in principle, depending on how you choose the virtual degrees of freedom, you can describe any state in FoxBase, whether it's a non-relativistic or relativistic, fermionic or bosonic. In practice, it then is an open question of how, say, useful they are for numerical methods. We know that, say, for example, in two dimensions, it's actually quite hard to construct, to compute expectation values. Potentially, because you pass to continuum, certain tasks might be easier. But this is an open question, and certainly demands investigation.
I apologize because I got kind of confused. So this is going to be a stupid question, but if you could you go back 3 slides?
Sure.
Or yeah, that. So to evaluate the state, this is the state of the real system, and it, so we specify the state, but then we also need to get a number. We also need to specify what sort of basis state we're projecting it on, right? What matrix? The numbers are matrix. So how? Is it R? I guess you have these matrices R and F. Which is it that specifies what the state chi is, and how do I also specify which component of that state, right? Which coefficient of the base? Do you understand?
So, the I think I understand what you're saying. The R matrix is really describing the coupling, which in the dynamical view is generating excitations physical state. But you still need to describe what the object generating excitation is doing. And so the function of the action is to describe that virtual system and its dynamics.
But suppose I want to evaluate, I have a given state that I want to represent this way, and I also want I want to compute the projection of that state on a particular basis state, so that I get a number. How do I input the basis? I guess we have R and M as a function of X and T, and these together have to encode not only the state of the original system, but also which component of that state. I'm, you know, at the end of the day, this the path integral is a number. So
yes. So to actually compute numbers, the path integral representation is a little cumbersome. But you can write this path integral, almost go backwards and view it as a unitary evolution or a one parameter evolution, which couples the two systems. And one can take that and say have an overlap of some other physical state or an expectation value of some operator with chi and basically eliminate the field degrees of freedom, the physical degrees of freedom, and write everything in terms of the boundary degrees of freedom. And so in the same way as in one dimension, back here, yes. Maybe this helps. On the left-hand side, you have something which is entirely in terms of the field, physical field. And on the right-hand side, you have the something which is entirely expressed in terms of the virtual or boundary degrees of freedom. And what this is really saying is it's encoding the dynamics up to a point X. So it's saying evolve to X, and then there's an event of an excitation as viewed from the virtual perspective, and then it just evolves naturally. And so you can always transfer the physical numbers of interest to the virtual level. Does that help?
I guess I see I see this example. I still don't understand completely how you would, maybe I'll ask you afterwards, but how you would compute, say, a particular component of this, you know, projection of the state chi onto a given reference basis state. But
So the extraction of expectation values in the two-dimensional case is still it still requires work and challenge to develop the method of computing expectation values. And the reason is because you can have an extremely non-trivial state. It's not that you're just creating a single particle, physical particle, and doing a scattering calculation. There's more structure there. And so to extract the numbers, it's in principle exactly the same way, but you have to be careful. So there isn't an easy answer in two dimensions, but it's clear how one would proceed.
To get a feel for your auxiliary field for interacting field theory, there are solved field theories like Thiering's model. So in that context, what will be the auxiliary fields? Is it already known, or it's a new insight that
it's certainly not known in this. So this just came out before Christmas. So the state of the art. With something like the Thiering model, it's a complete class of states, and so the question then is,
for example, about the ground state. I'd
yes.
like to know about the ground state and see the nature of how the accelerator feels.
I would expect that with a relatively modest bond dimension, that either you could access the ground state or get close to it.
Because I know that sometimes there are bound states and mass gaps and so on.
Yes.
So are these auxiliary fields like a glue that binds particles?
Yeah, it's not clear at present. It's not clear at present. I mean, maybe the intuition for the machinery is that it's like with Fourier analysis. In Fourier analysis, you have expansion in terms of momenta, degrees of freedom. But then you might truncate the high degrees of freedom and say, OK, I'm not going to worry about those, integrate them out, and work with a bounded set. So the machinery that I would like to develop is something like this, but with entanglement, where the focus is not on necessarily local observables, but more the non-local properties. And so that's really the program, to develop that calculus, that machine. And so questions such as this are obvious targets to look at. Yeah.
One last small
question. Sure,
what about Mera states? Do they have this kind of representations?
There is a C-Mera, yes. I don't know that much about it, but it certainly can be done. I mean, and it would be nice to look at critical systems or topological order in field states.
So are you saying that given a specific interacting field theory, you can represent it this by these means?
In principle, yes. In the same way as if you have the traditional representation of field states in terms of excitations, say local particle excitation, that you have in principle a complete you have a way of filling out the Hilbert space. The same is true here.
I mean, I guess my question is, how does this relate to so Robert Hübner and Jens Eisert and their stuff. So Robert came and spoke in various places. And I mean, how does this relate to their stuff? Because I mean, the message kind of he was giving was that it wasn't really clear what, okay, he's trying to represent fields, but it wasn't clear what the field theory is. And then furthermore, it's not clear that they're interacting on free fields. And then further work on looking at the ground state suggested that this was, they are just free, basically. So if you're claiming that somebody's interacting and you can do specific ones, how does this relate to what he's talking about? Especially given that Jens is one of your co-authors.
Yes, yes. but I don't think I'm co-author with Jens. So I suppose you aren't restricted. At no point do you specify the physical Hamiltonian or the physical action. So it's expected that you'll have problems describing phase transitions with something like this. The degree to which you can analyze specific problems in interaction fields is still unclear. But any state in Fock space you can represent.
Okay, but in terms of the relation to Robert and Jens, I mean, is this...
The Wick's theorem paper?
He spoke about that, but then there's this just in terms of just... I can't really retrieve, but he's spoken a few times, and yeah, well, I was hoping you could tell him. But I mean, I guess the bottom line, as I said, is in terms of his work, well, when he was talking, he was presenting work at QIP, he was saying that, looking at Brass and saying that it suggested that it was kind of free, basically, the fields that are represented. And then when he came here, he was talking about his Wick's theorem thing here a few weeks ago. And then he was kind of saying it's unclear what, in terms of, okay, what is it an underlying, okay, you can do it, but what's an underlying Hamiltonian, so what is the theory?
Yeah, I'm still unclear on their Wick's theorem work. I don't quite see how it connects with the standard Wick's theorem in quantum field theory. So I'm less familiar with their work. So I'm not sure what they're claiming in that regard.
Okay, so you're just saying that somehow all this you've represented is quite distinct from
So Jens has a paper on the continuous measurement description of one-dimensional CMPS. As far as I know, he has done this and the Wick's theorem work. I don't know. Maybe I've missed another one, but I don't know. Maybe we can talk afterwards.
So maybe we should end the official part now and just have further discussions afterwards if you like. So let's thank David again.